大家好，我是周子瑜。
Hello everyone, I'm 周子瑜。I'm sorry. I should have come forward and apologized earlier. Because I didn't know how to face this situation. I was too scared to face everyone directly.
That's 16-year-old Taiwanese singer, Zhou Ziyu, speaking in a video released on January 15th. The normally scantily clad and made-up pop star was here wearing a turtleneck sweater while reading from a script and repeatedly bowing down in contrition.
There is only one China. The two sides of the streets are one. I have always felt proud to be Chinese. While taking part in activities abroad, I went too far with my words and actions.
It was a public apology, and Jill's supposed transgression had come 2 months earlier when she waved a Republic of China flag while performing on South Korean TV. The flag has represented Taiwan since the Kuomintang Party, or KMT, fled to the island in 1949 after losing control of mainland China to the Communist Party. This is one of the most hot-button sensitive issues for the mainland, and indeed for the region. For 7 decades, Taiwan has been self-governing, but still claimed by China, where the ROC flag is considered a secessionist symbol. So Zhou's display drew ire in the mainland, a major market for her pop group and management company. Hence, the apology.
I hurt my company, the feelings of my online fans, on both sides of the street. I'm very, very sorry about that.
The video immediately went viral in Taiwan, and it came at a key moment. The next day, voters went to the polls to choose the island's next president and parliament. 11% of voters said they were influenced by the apology.
This particular incident will serve as a constant reminder to me about the importance of our country's strength and unity to those outside our borders.
That's the woman who won the presidency, Tsai Ing-wen of the traditionally pro-independence Democratic Progressive Party, or DPP, speaking at a press conference on January 16th. She'd just been elected in a landslide.
The results of today's election showcases the will of the Taiwanese people. It is the shared resolve of Taiwan's 23 million people that the Republic of China is a democratic country. Our democratic system, national identity, and international space must be respected.
Tsai will be just the second DPP leader and the first woman to ever hold Taiwan's highest office. It will also be the first time the DPP will have control of both the presidency and the parliament.
The results today tell me that the people want to see a government more willing to listen to the people, a government that is more transparent and accountable, and a government that is steadfast in protecting this country's sovereignty.
For 8 years under the previous Kuomintang-led government, Taiwan allowed its people and business to link more closely with mainland China in hopes of easing tensions and boosting the economy. Zhou Ziyu's apology, though hardly a decisive factor in the election, embodied growing fears that these policies were making Taiwan vulnerable. So where did Beijing and Taiwan's Kuomintang Party go wrong?
Sometimes familiarity breeds contempt. Just because you have more people from another country visit you doesn't mean they're going to love you.
The trend in the last few years is that people increasingly are identifying themselves as Taiwanese, not Chinese.
The one country, two system is irrelevant to Taiwan. All the horrible things you see on Taiwanese TV about Hong Kong's disappearing booksellers just enhance that impression.
Today we'll look at how skepticism of China played into the DPP's rise to power and what that could mean for the future of cross-strait relations. I'm Eric Fish, and this is the Asia Society Podcast.
People on China are watching their assumption that emollients, trade, social contacts would draw the people of Taiwan closer to the mainland.
That's Douglas Powell, a former unofficial U.S. representative to Taiwan. He was speaking at an Asia Society event in New York.
They used to say, try to use the policy that Kangxi, the emperor of China, used in the 17th century. Don't compel the people of Taiwan to come back to the mainland. Win them back through inducements and good relations. And that's clearly not working. It must be viewed in China as a failure, which raises very big questions about what they'll do confronted with a failure.
Since 1979, China had sought to bring Taiwan closer peacefully through what it called three links, referring to transportation, trade, and postage. By enabling stronger ties between people on both sides, Beijing wagered that it would set the groundwork for a political reunification. In 2008, it got a chance to seriously test this strategy. Kuomintang Party candidate Ma Ying-jeou won Taiwan's presidency after he ran on a platform of improving the economy and relieving tensions through greater ties with China. Almost immediately after taking office, barriers to travel and trade across the strait began to fall.
I think it's panned out well in terms of air transportation, sea transportation.
That's Jerome Cohen, director of the U.S. Asia Law Institute at NYU. Cohen has been a scholar on Chinese law and human rights since the 1960s and had been President Ma Ying-jeou's professor at Harvard.
It's brought huge numbers of Taiwanese to the mainland. It's brought large numbers of mainland Chinese to Taiwan. It's enhanced business, trade, investment.
Under Ma's presidency, the total trade volume between Taiwan and the mainland has nearly doubled, from $105 to $198 billion, by the most recent estimates. Taiwanese tourists to the mainland have also increased from 4.4 to 5.4 million per year, while mainlanders going the other direction have grown more than 13-fold, from 300,000 to almost 4 million. Using these indicators, the two sides are the closest they've been since the Civil War. But it hasn't necessarily had the effect that Beijing hoped for.
Sometimes familiarity breeds contempt. And just because you have more people from another country visit you doesn't mean they're going to love you. They may find more reason to vindicate their prejudice against you. I think having many people from the mainland visit Taiwan by and large is good for Taiwan. Of course, there are always certain security risks, but they're heavily outweighed by the fact that mainland people are impressed by Taiwan. They're impressed even by the economic level of the people and certainly by the political freedom that they witness, and often what they learn about the legal system. Taiwan people visiting the mainland, that's another story. Although you have almost a million people from Taiwan living on the mainland long run and successfully doing business, even those people who are more accustomed to the mainland, they're clearly aware of the big differences between the way the mainland is run and the way Taiwan is run.
China has promised that if there's reunification, Taiwan may, quote, practice systems different from those on the mainland and enjoy a high degree of autonomy, unquote. But over the past few years, Taiwan has looked on with growing skepticism at another place, Hong Kong, which was returned to China in 1997 under the same promise.
Hong Kong's problems retaining genuine autonomy under the so-called one country, two systems reign that was instituted beginning 1997 for 50 years. Those problems have reinforced most Taiwan people's determination to stay separate from the mainland. One country, two systems was a formula first put forward by the mainland leaders for Taiwan, but Taiwan didn't want any. They would only be subordinate. And why should they, especially when the mainland remains a dictatorship, voluntarily become part of that system?
Cohen pointed to recent events in Hong Kong suggesting that the mainland's authoritarian reach is supplanting the autonomy it promised. Things like proposed changes to the education curriculum that would give a more China-friendly view, or the subduing of the territory's once freewheeling media, or the disappearance and possible kidnapping of several publishers who printed books critical of Chinese leaders. And most notably, Beijing's refusal to allow Hong Kong citizens to directly nominate and elect their top leader.
Why should Taiwan be attracted to that? It's just the opposite. People in Hong Kong are envying the situation of Taiwan.
In 2014, concerns over Taiwan's relationship with the mainland became evident when some 200 students stormed the offices of Taiwan's legislator and held it for several weeks in what became known as the Sunflower Movement. It was in response to a proposed trade pact with the mainland, backed by President Ma Ying-jeou and the Kuomintang, because it would supposedly boost the economy. But critics said the measure was being pushed through covertly without adequate public review, and that it could actually hurt the economy and leave Taiwan vulnerable to political pressure from Beijing. The episode was a major setback for the Kuomintang, and the underlying issues would be felt in 2016.
The major reason is really the widespread dissatisfaction with President Ma and the KMT.
That's Taiwanese research scholar Yujia Chin of the U.S. Asia Law Institute of NYU. At the Asia Society event, she explained why the recent election outcome was so lopsided.
You know, the economy has been quite slow in Taiwan, and people feel their stagnant salaries are not catching up with the prices of everything, the rising housing price. So it's a sense of frustration about what's supposed to be KMT's strong suit economy. That's what they always boast about. But the promised benefit of the closer cross-strait cooperation did not really pan out as the KMT and the MA promised. So there was a sense of great discontent with closer cross-strait relations and yet no obvious economic benefit.
Polls found that, for all the concerns about the mainland's heavy hand, by far the biggest issue for voters was the economy, which grew by less than 1% in 2015. Relations with China actually only ranked around 6th or 7th in the list of voter concerns.
The mainland policy of President Ma has been good in many respects, especially for big business in China. But the smaller business people and the average working person isn't very happy. The economy is not making too much progress at the moment. They feel their standard of living is diminishing. And there's a great preoccupation with economics, as there is everywhere when you have an election. Nevertheless, they know mainland policy is related to the economic situation.
The DPP had disproportionate support among young voters, and Douglas Powell says that much of their discontent with China likely stems from globalization and economic dynamics that are hardly unique to Taiwan.
Hong Kong and Taiwan have, and this is not just them, it's also Singapore, and you could even say Spain and Italy, got a lot of unemployed youth with good education backgrounds, but they're not getting the opportunities they thought they would get, whether it's a shortage of housing or the job offers don't pay what they thought they would pay. And, you know, in Taiwan, this is really an acute problem, which showed up in the Sunflower Movement. You have 171 universities on a small island with 23 million people. And they're coming out of these four-year colleges with expectations of the secretary, the office, the car, and those jobs are not there. They could get jobs at advanced, you know, non-Darwinian, beautiful factories running the robots that produce things for the modern economy, but they don't want those. They've got different expectations. And both Hong Kong and Taiwan suffer because they used to be the go-betweens between the outside world and the China market. They had a special privilege, they could get a special salary access. That's gone now. The Chinese have had all the people they need, well-educated, to take care of those jobs. So they've lost that special edge, and it's very hard for the leaders, Hong Kong, Singapore, or Taiwan, to substitute for what that is missing. And doing that in a down market is going to be especially tough.
Powell says, though, that if Taiwan hopes to wean itself off economic dependence on China, it's going to have a hard time.
Most people in Taiwan think maybe Taiwan makes $20 billion a year out of trade with China, when in fact it's in the hundreds of billions of dollars. The sense of dependency is underappreciated because it's a much bigger planet around which Taiwan orbits when it comes to economics. Finding alternative markets and platforms is going to be very tough. The other parts of the region are not going to open up the kinds of doors that Taiwan needs comparably to what the mainland has offered for Taiwan investors. They've looked at India, they've looked at Indonesia, they've probably saturated Vietnam with garment and footwear makers. So the chances are not so good there. And then you've got the general economic climate. All the warning signs are out, Christine Lagarde and Davos and everybody else talking about expect lower rates of growth. So they're going into headwinds on Taiwan, where you try to extract growth through better exports by tightening up your internal regulatory regime to make your people more competitive in the international marketplace. But there may not be much of a marketplace out there, so that's going to be a challenge for them.
Yujia Chin says that Tsai Ing-wen and the DPP offered an appealing alternative to the Kuomintang's economic policies, which helped them get elected.
I think they're very successful in this campaign. They proposed a very convincing economic agenda of trade diversification, domestic liberalization, innovation, and job creation. On the other hand, they try not to highlight the issue of cross-strait relations, which is always their sort of weakest link in their campaign. So this time, Tsai has been doing very well in saying, we are going to maintain the status quo and peace and stability.
As far as cross-strait relations are concerned, the newly elected president has been relatively quiet thus far.
In all of the surveys in Taiwan in recent years, the vast majority of people support the status quo, and very tiny percentage support unification, and also very tiny percentage would support independence. And many also interpret the so-called status quo as de facto independence, because we do have our own government running our own country. So in that sense, you could say that the vast majority of people would like to keep the status quo and keep a certain distance from China without being over-relying on China for economic benefits. But I believe most of the people who want status quo also realize that we are only 100 miles away from China, and there's no way that we can avoid this topic. So Tai was walking and is still going to walk a very tight rope in handling cross-strait relations. She is a very cool-headed person. She often has been criticized for not showing too much emotion in public. She is very calm in terms of her rhetoric. So in that sense, she handled this issue very well in the campaign.
As Douglas Powell points out, Taiwanese people have already been steadily moving away from the mainland psychologically.
The trend in the last few years, judging from the good of polling in Taiwan, is that people increasingly are identifying themselves as Taiwanese, not Chinese. In the period prior to that, there was more ambivalence. People say, I'm Chinese, I'm Taiwanese first, but I'm also Chinese. That's really going away fast. That's a big challenge to the PRC.
So what happens if this trend continues? Chinese President Xi Jinping has given some indication of a harder line than his predecessor. In 2013, he reportedly warned a senior Taiwanese envoy that a resolution to the Taiwan question can't be postponed forever. So what if, rather than seeing any momentum towards reunification, he watches the island drift further away?
A lot depends on other internal developments in the mainland. Xi Jinping, on the one hand, has enjoyed enormous worldwide prestige, as has China in the last few years. On the other hand, I'm among those who thinks he's on very slippery turf, that despite his confident travels at home, things are not going well. And that could work to Taiwan's advantage, because it certainly will keep them preoccupied. They may be so preoccupied, and they need now a stable external environment, including Taiwan. On the other hand, there's the theory that he may turn to nationalism as a diversion against the inability to deal with some of these difficult challenges at home.
I'm a little different from most observers about China. The last couple of years, I see a less assertive Xi Jinping. China was assertive from 08 to 12 in a willy-nilly kind of way, and it cost them a lot. They lost Burma, they lost other things. And he's been trying to put the pieces back together again. So he's come up with this infrastructure investment bank to tie markets and infrastructure together with China. He's come up with the One Belt, One Road, which is trying to spread Chinese markets out, do good for Chinese domestic industries too at the same time. But it has an international effect, lowering tensions with Japan in the last year, plus trying to cultivate relations with North Korea and South Korea, which has hit a big bump in the road just in the last couple of weeks, and then really working on Southeast Asia. So I think he's not going to be one just to jump to a negative posture vis-a-vis Taiwan.
Also, Xi Jinping's hands are pretty tight now, with a lot of going on domestically with his anti-corruption campaign that has alienated a lot of Chinese officials, with a slow economy to handle, and with the tension over South China Sea problems. So I do think that although she appears to be a very tough character, especially if you look at his domestic repression on lawyers and civil society, that's just unprecedented and very unfortunate. But I think his policy options towards Taiwan now are sort of limited due to other factors that he needs to take into consideration. So I agree with Doc's analysis that he is not going to jump to a very negative start.
But in closing, Jerome Cohen took a long view and explored what could happen under a seemingly distant scenario that many people are hoping for, that the authoritarian mainland becomes more like democratic Taiwan rather than vice versa.
When we think of the future 30 years from now, optimists hope, despite recent developments, that there will be a new direction on the mainland, and we will see further development of genuine democracy, transparency, the rule of law, political and civil rights. All of that would be wonderful. We don't know whether that will happen. But if it should happen, we can't necessarily comfort ourselves, because there are many examples in history, including American history, where a democratic society is subject to nationalistic pressures and leadership. And it may be that having a dictatorship keeps the people of China under more control, whereas a democracy could lead them to an assault against Taiwan in the name of national unification. We can't tell.
That's all for today. If you want to hear more episodes, you can go to asiasociety.org/podcast or subscribe on iTunes. You can also follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Asia Society. Our music is by Thierry Mangmang and his ensemble, Shui Minta Bin Zapwe. They were performing live at Asia Society in New York as part of a season of Myanmar. I'm Eric Fish, and we'll see you next time on the Asia Society podcast.